Well, it's great to be back with you. I'm glad that you came out again. Thank you for that. And we'll have a great time slated for today to think about some more interesting things. The method that we're going to be using quite a bit through the morning is a well-recognized approach to understanding the Bible. That is, we observe very carefully what the text says. We ask questions. We pay attention to questions that we might ask that maybe we haven't asked before. And then we go on a hunt, trying to find answers to those questions. And you'll see that working as we go through it today. So as you listen to the points I have to make, please listen also to the methodology that I'm using, because that's something that you can extend through your work with Scripture whenever you're reading. So we're going to start with text analysis. We laid the foundation last night in hermeneutics, in methodology, in understanding how we think about authority, how we think about the Bible and science. And so we've got those pieces in place. And now that's the foundation that we'll build on as we go into the understanding of the biblical text. In this hour, I'm going to talk about Genesis 1. The next hour, just before lunch, I'm going to talk about Genesis 2. And then this afternoon, we're going to try to take all of that we learned in those two to bring it together and to give us a picture of how we think about the Bible and science and those kinds of issues. So that's sort of how the day is scheduled out in our discussions. You'll have time to talk in groups this afternoon. You'll have time for Q&A this afternoon. So that's what you've got to look forward to. So, text analysis. We open up to Genesis chapter 1, and we begin to read about the first day. And I want to take us immediately to verse 5, which is the end of the account of the first day. And there it says that God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And, you know, you might say, well, that sounds pretty mundane, you know, that's pretty straightforward, nothing going on there, just move on to another verse. But wait a minute. Have you ever stopped to ask the question, why didn't God call the light light? What do you mean God called the light day? What are we talking about? Day is not the same as light. Light is not the same as day. Why does he call the light day? We're certainly not talking like physicists here, but remember, we don't expect the ancient Israelites to be talking or thinking like physicists. So put that out of your mind. So what are they thinking about when they read or hear God called the light day? It seems such an obvious question to ask, but it's not one that many people pause to think about. And those are the kinds of things I'm addressing, where we wouldn't even think to ask the question. But asking the question is going to open up new vistas for understanding. So, what is it that God called day? The fact that the verse ends with day and night seems to suggest that that's where day one is going. Day one is not really about light. Day one is about day and night. And when we talk about light, then, we ought to understand it in terms of the objective, day and night. So we ask the question, we've got day, what does day have to do with light? Well, you could answer that pretty easily just with a little bit of thought, and maybe you've already jumped to it yourself just sitting there. Day equals a period of light. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward, and that makes some sense of what we've got here. God called the period of light day. We know it means period of light because that's what day is. And the period of darkness he called night. Well, that's a simple fix. So that's pretty good, feeling good about that. Let's move back up a verse. Verse 4. God separated the light from the darkness. Now, again, you say, well, we know we're not talking physics on this one. You can't have light and darkness together, so you can't separate them. Darkness is the absence of light. This is not physics. Right. It is not physics. But here we're now ready because we already had a solution in verse 5, and we can use the same solution in verse 4. Okay, God separated, distinguished between period of light and period of darkness. Remember, in verse 2, when the whole thing started, we had just darkness. Okay? And now God's distinguishing between a period of light and a period of darkness, and he names the periods of light day, and the periods of darkness he names night, evening and morning, day one. Going good. I like this. Okay, you get paid to do this? Yeah, I do. Isn't that cool? Okay? But now we're ready for the big one. If you're with me so far, I've got you. Okay? Let's move back to verse 3. God said, let there be, wait for it. What did we learn in verse 5? What did we learn in verse 4? God said, let there be a period of light. And God separated periods of light from periods of darkness, named the period of light day, period of darkness night. So what is it that God is creating on day one? On day one, God created the basis of time. In his first step to bring order to the cosmos. Day one is not about God creating light. It is about God creating time. So he calls a period of light into existence that he is going to name day, distinguishes it from periods of darkness that he names night. Now, the whole approach I have to Genesis started right there. After 20, 25 years of thinking hard about Genesis, thinking hard about the ancient Near East and how to read Genesis in light of the ancient Near East, it was actually when I was standing in front of a class teaching Genesis 1. It was a Hebrew class. There were only 3 or 4 students in there. Going through the Hebrew, just like I just took you through it, except I was using Hebrew as we did it, and got to this very point, which I had gotten to other times before in front of other classes. Okay, period of light, day and night, couldn't separate them. God said, let there be a period of light, and so God created time. I'd gotten there before. And then something unusual happened, as sometimes happens when I'm in the middle of a lecture. I said the next line, just kind of off the cuff, and it changed radically how I thought about Genesis. Because I made the statement, time is not an object. Now, of course time is not an object, but think of the implications. On day one, God is not creating an object. He's creating time. You know, even if we thought he was creating light, and some people might still kind of hold on to that a little bit, but even if we think that's true, do the Israelites think light is an object? Can we even manage to think of light as an object, even if we know wave theory and particle theory and all of modern physics? We still have trouble thinking of light as an object. The Israelites certainly didn't think of light as an object. So, for the Israelite audience, this is not a statement about God creating an object. Now, it was when I made that statement. Time is not an object. Time is no object. Yeah. Time is not an object that I made the next statement. What kind of creation account is this? If it's not looking at something, the manufacturer of objects, what is it? What kind of origins account do we have here? Do you see how from a very innocent question, why didn't God call the light light, to a little bit of thought, and then the big conclusion, time is not an object, to the huge question, what kind of account are we dealing with here? Sometimes you have to go through a sequence to get to the big question. And that leads me to ask the question then, what is going on in this text? Now, let me make something really, really clear. God created everything there is. God created objects, God created functions, God created order, God created us, God created everything. There's nothing that exists that God did not create. Okay? Having said that, we've got a different question on the table. We want to know what part of that story of God's creating is Genesis 1 telling. After all, they've only got 30-some verses. You can't tell everything about everything God created. You're going to pick and choose. You're going to focus on what you think is important. And so we're not asking the theological question, what are all the things God created? We're asking the literary question, what part of the story is Genesis 1 telling? What's its focus? And that focus is going to be based on an Israelite way of thinking and an Israelite culture, as we talked about last night. It's not going to be based on the things we think are most important. It's going to be based on the things that they are inclined to think are most important, but more significantly, what God thinks is most important. Imagine that you had some tickets to a play. You had waited a long time to get these tickets, and it was really a nice play. You were really looking forward to it. And so you head off down to the theater, and you get caught in traffic, and you know things just don't go right. You can't find parking, and then you end up further away than you thought. And by the time you actually get to the theater, you're 15 minutes late, and it's already begun. And you know, the place is dark and things are going on the stage, and you look at your tickets, and when you got those tickets, you thought those were great tickets because they're right down in front. But right now, that's a little bit embarrassing. So you kind of, you know, you sheepishly walk down the aisle and try to be as inconspicuous as possible. And of course, you're in the middle of the row, not at the end. And so, excuse me. You have to squeeze by everybody, and everybody's kind of sighing this, why can't you come on? You know, you're totally mortified. And you sit down in your seat. But now, of course, things are happening, and you have no idea, you know, where you are. And so, since you're already very embarrassed, you poke the person next to you, and you say, how did the play begin? You don't expect that person to say, well, this theater was built in 1932, and the architect was Borman and Borman Associates. They had some unique ideas about acoustics and how they did that. The script for this play was written in 1956. It won a Pulitzer Prize. And the cast was chosen by the... No. Wrong story. True story, but wrong story. You don't want to hear that part about how the play began. You want to hear what's been going on the stage. It's a particular question with a particular expectation. When you ask an Israelite, how did the cosmos begin? We have to figure out what kind of question they would think that is and what answers would be most meaningful to them. Okay, the text is not going to answer everyone's origins questions. It's going to target toward Israelites, toward theology. So, our task is a literary one. How did the cosmos begin? What part of the cosmos are we talking about? What aspect of the cosmos? Okay, so we ask the question, what kind of origins account is this? Literary question that has theological ramifications. Okay, you with me? So, if we're going to ask what kind of creation account is this, we better take a look at this Hebrew word, create. The Hebrew word is bara, and it's translated right there in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so, what does it mean? What would an Israelite understand when they hear a statement like that, when it talks about God creating? What are creative activities? Now, again, that's not a question that you would necessarily think to ask, because you read in your English text and you might think, I already know what creation is. I already know what that verb means. I already know the activity that's involved. But all of those things are already set up in your mind culturally. And it's the ideas that an English text brings to your attention. And of course, even when we talk about reading the text seriously, indeed reading the text literally, we can't think that we can get away with reading the English text literally, because English text is translation. Someone's interpreted that. All translation is interpretation. So you say, well, boy, you're really sticking me here because I don't know Hebrew. Well, that's why we all work together, and I can help you kind of work through some of this so you understand what's going on. That's kind of a step that we have to take here. So what does the Hebrew verb mean, and how would have an Israelite heard it? Bara, created. Well, you know, even if we start in English, we can recognize that the verb in English, create, has a wide range of possibilities. Think about, for instance, if you talked about creating a committee. What kind of creative work is that? How about creating a curriculum? Creating a masterpiece? Creating a recipe? Creating havoc? Interesting, the wide range of uses we have for this English word create. We should expect there might be the same kinds of variations in Hebrew. It's something to explore. Now, in those English examples that I just gave you, we understand the type of creating that's involved by the direct object. Committee, curriculum, recipe, masterpiece, those are direct objects. And by understanding the nature of the direct object, we get some kind of sense of what the creative activity would have been. So in that sense, we can see that we come to understand the verb, English, create, by its usage with various direct objects that are appropriate for it. That's the same procedure that we'd use in Hebrew. Biblical authors left us a lot of books, but a dictionary was not among them. That means that we have to figure out what these words mean. That's our task as interpreters. We have to figure out what they mean. We figure out what words mean by usage, always. You do it in your language by how words are used. Basically, society has an agreement about certain words and how they're used and what they mean, and that's how we understand one another. And usage can change. Words can change their meaning. Google used to be a technical mathematical term. Now it's a verb. Changes its meaning. Now, even in different segments of a language, you can have different words used differently. I've been experiencing that. Being in Australia and being in New Zealand, English is a different language here. You know, I'm still trying to figure out what's tea and what's supper and what's dinner and what's lunch and what those things refer to, because it's not the same things that those mean in American English. And not the same things they meant in UK English. I mean, everything's got, that's usage, same language, but usage gives different meaning. And a culture agrees on these kinds of usage and meanings. So when we want to understand a biblical word, a Hebrew word, we look at usage. We look at how it shows up in the biblical text and figure out all that we can about how it is being used. So let's take a look at this verb bara. Now we have to kind of clear create out of the way here, because after all, the English shape of the word create and all its possibilities might be different than the Hebrew shape of bara. They overlap to the extent that you can translate one from the other, but they're not necessarily exactly the same. So we have to look at the usage of the Hebrew verb. Oh yeah, there it is, in Genesis 1:1. So we have about 50 occurrences. You know, there's a tool called a concordance. A concordance, you can look up all the occurrences of a particular word in the Bible and see where they are. An English tool, you could use it and find this information. There are about 50 occurrences of the Hebrew verb bara. It only takes God as its subject, an interesting point, but not the one that's going to get us where we need to go. It does say that it's a divine activity. What we want to know about is the direct objects. Okay, just like I did with masterpiece and curriculum. It takes a wide variety of objects, and here's just a brief summary of some of the categories. I've got a comprehensive list in the book, Lost World of Genesis 1, but here's a select group to show you some of the variations. And as you look at these direct objects will tell you something about the nature of the creative activity. That is, you can ask the question, is this verb all about God manufacturing objects? Well, you could rule that one out pretty quick, looking at a list like this. These are not objects. Created me a pure heart, O God. That's not a heart transplant. Okay, that's not a material object. Even though your heart is a material object, that's not what it's talking about. Okay, and then you have things like calamity or darkness that God creates. Wow, what would that mean? What does that creative activity look like? So we can see that bara shows itself by usage to be something that is not focused on objects, material, physical stuff. We could not say that since it says create, it must mean manufacturing physical objects. No, it doesn't. Look at the list. So we find that there's kind of a wide variety here. Now, if we start looking at those and say, okay, what kinds of things are these? What kind of activity is bara that it could include these kinds of things? And you start to understand that, well, this has to do more with things like organization. Like when you create a committee, that's an organizational act of creation. Okay, they have to do with things like order, bringing order to something. When you create a recipe, for instance, that has to do with how things function, how they work. Okay, those are all legitimate ways to think about creation, bara. So creation doesn't have to be something material, physical. It can be something organizational. It can be something connected with order, with functions, any number of different possibilities. So when we're trying to answer the question, what kind of creation account is this? We start to see that various possibilities are on the table just from the verb bara. Now, when we saw in day one, that time was the result of creative activities, we say, well, that's certainly not an object. It fits more with a matter of order, with how things function. Okay, so we're kind of moving that direction. As we looked at day one, we've got other things to look at, but we can start formulating hypotheses as this all works together. Now, another way we can go about this is to say, okay, if there's a creating taking place, whether it's physical and material, or whether it's organizational or functional or whatever, if that's taking place, there should be a before and an after. What did it look like before? You know, so with a committee. Before, there were people doing their jobs and being productive. Then there's a committee and things change. No, okay, no. And so now there's a new order that's brought about. That's an organizational kind of work. So you look at the before and the after pictures. Well, let's do that here in Genesis 1. What's the before picture look like? That then leads us through bara and to the results of Genesis 1. What's that before picture? That's very important for us to understand the nature of the verb. We find that before picture in verse 2. We do not find it in verse 1. Let me talk a little about verse 1, then we'll come back to verse 2. Verse 1 is the one we know. In the beginning, God created, bara, the heavens and the earth, the cosmos. Okay? Now, what kind of statement is that? Is that actually an event, an activity that's being communicated? Okay, well, no, it's not. We can tell that contextually. That is, at the end of the 7 days, it comes back and says, so, in those 7 days, God created the heavens and the earth. So we know that verse 1 is not referring to something that happened before the 7 days. Verse 1 is not the preparation for the 7 days. Verse 1 is what happened during the 7 days. It's not a separate, independent creative act. It is rather an introduction to the 7 days of creative acts. And that's why increasingly scholars today have recognized that verse 1 is a literary introduction to the 7 days. It's not talking about anything that happened in verse 1. It's going to talk about what happens in the 7 days. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let me tell you how he did it. Okay? Literary introduction. Nothing happening there. So verse 2 is the beginning of the story. Now, this is very interesting because if we're going to have this idea of creating in some form or fashion, we're trying to understand it, creation is going to move something from non-existence to existence. Okay, the committee did not exist, and then it did exist. The curriculum didn't exist, and then it did exist. This, okay, a Jerusalem didn't exist, and it did exist. Okay, you get the idea. Bara, create, moving from non-existence to existence. So, what does the non-existence look like? Verse 2. So let's pay close attention. So we open up our Bibles, and we read in verse 2. Now the earth was... Hold it! Hold it! The earth? Where'd that come from? Why are you starting with that? The earth. It's already there. Move on. The earth was formless and void. Formless. Void. Okay. So is it Plato? Just sitting there, a clump of Plato? What are we talking about? If it is, then it's already there. Go on. And darkness was over the surface of the deep. Wait! The deep? What's happening here? See what happens if you let yourself ask questions? You never get out of verse 2. But look at what we've got here. As the before picture is laid out, we've already got material on the stage. The earth is there. The water's there. Already in place. That tells us something important. The starting point is not lacking matter. The starting point is lacking order. Now, if that's the case, then again we ask the question, what then is creating doing? If it's not bringing about all the matter, what is it doing? And we find that it's lacking order. Now, if you read ancient Near Eastern texts, that immediately rings a familiar chord. Because in the ancient Near East, darkness and sea are elements of non-order. In ancient cosmologies, you start with a non-ordered situation, not a non-material situation, a non-ordered situation, and then creation is bringing about order. Now, Israel doesn't have to be the same. You know, again, I'm not imposing that idea from the ancient Near East, but we wouldn't be surprised if Israel is the same. That's not an issue of theology, it's an issue of how you think about things. Okay, so we wouldn't be surprised if Israel thought the same way. And here we see this similar element, darkness and sea. But we want to understand the Hebrew text, so we have to look at this word tohu. Tohu is a word that's usually translated formless. The other one, empty or void, is the word bohu. It makes a really cool sounding thing in Hebrew, tohu vavohu, you know, like blah, 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 blah. Tohu vavohu. Okay, so what do these words mean? Again, we go through the same process. We say, how is tohu used throughout the Bible? We can't ask much about bohu, the second one, because that only occurs 3 times and always with tohu and always referring back to Genesis 1. So that one doesn't help us. But tohu we get lots of shots at, 20, 25, something like that. And so we can see how it's used. And we find that it pertains to not being formless, that is lacking material shape, but it pertains to lacking purpose and order. In other words, they thought of it as non-ordered, not yet organized. Think about when you move into a new house or a new apartment. Okay? It's not that it would be formless, you know, just a globular sort of room that you had to... Okay? It's not that, but it is lacking order. Here, everything's in boxes. Okay, it's materially there, but everything's in boxes and it needs to be ordered. So it's non-ordered and it needs to be ordered. Now, for the Israelites in the ancient world, this has to do with the very nature of existence. We tend to think that something exists when it has material form. Now, I'm not going back to Plato and Aristotle here. That's a big conversation. But just typically how we normally think today. We would say, if I ask you, does this chair exist? Well, yeah. Well, how do you know it exists? Well, I can see it. I can touch it. I can sit on it. It won't collapse. It exists. It's there. That's a material category. So in that sense, we identify existence as a material category. And we never stop to ask, is there another way to think? Is there a different category for existence to take? Let me give you an example. Do you have the Dilbert cartoon here in Australia? The Dilbert, you're familiar with that? Kind of the office where everything goes crazy. Anyway, so Dilbert's in there talking to his boss, and the boss says, you know, every project you've worked on this year has been canceled. It's as if you don't exist. And Dilbert says, hold it, wait a minute. I exist. I take up space. That's material, right? I take up space. I'm a material. Okay. I take up space. The boss says, a dead person can take up space. He's not usually that clever in the cartoon strip, but a dead person can take up space. And Dilbert thinks a minute, he says, well, a dead person exists. Really? Does a dead person exist? Material, but not functional. The last frame, Dilbert's talking to Wally, his buddy, and he says, you know, I won the argument, but it was really a hollow victory. All he did was prove himself like a dead person. But anyway, so this question of what constitutes existence, I'm not trying to get philosophical on you. I am not a philosophically minded person, and I get lost in it very quickly. I stick to the solid ground of analysis. But at any rate, but what we do have to ask the question, because here's a place where we could impose our own ways of thinking on an ancient text without even knowing we're doing it. Because we didn't even consider that there would be options or alternatives. Look at this Egyptian concept. The Egyptian parallel, they talk about the non-existent very specifically. And they talk about the non-existent as a reference to that which has not yet been differentiated and assigned a function, yet having potential. They will talk about the desert as non-existent. We go, wow. They would talk about the cosmic ocean, the sea, as non-existent. And you say, that just doesn't make sense in our framework. And you're right, it doesn't. But it made sense to them. And that's how they thought about it. And it's likely the Israelites thought the same way. I think tohu is the same kind of word, non-existent, the way the Egyptians would have thought about it. Because we see them using that word in the same kinds of contexts. So when they're thinking about something as non-existent, they're not thinking about material properties. They're thinking about functions and order. So for them, the movement from non-existence to existence is creating order and functions. Not creating molecules and atoms, not creating material objects, because they have a different way of thinking about existence. These are the kinds of things I was referring to last night when I said we have to get on their mental wavelength. We have to think the way that they do. Otherwise, we're going to make the text something that it never was, because we're reading it through our lens, through our understandings and our assumptions. If we do that, it's danger. It leads to distortion. So what we've learned is, follow what we've done this morning so far. We've learned that day one, at least, is not an object. Time, light, not an object. That the verb, bara, create, does not inherently deal with objects, and that the starting point is not connected to the lack of objects, but the lack of order. Time has to do with organization, order, and function. Bara has to do with order, organization, and function. The starting point suggests we're lacking order, organization, and function. Are you starting to see a pattern? Again, we're still trying to ask, what kind of creation account is this? And it may not be the kind that we are naturally inclined to think that it is. So, I want to propose that the kind of origins account we have here is that it has to do with functions and order, not with material. That the account is not intended to be the origins of the material cosmos, but that it is talking about how order came about in this cosmos. A different story, a different question, a different answer. In the ancient functional focus, existence is defined by having a function. And by that, I don't mean that an animal can walk, a function, or a burning ball of gas can burn and bring heat and light. Not that kind of function. I'm talking about functions for people, order in this world. This is the beginning of our ordered world. Okay, in terms of being ordered for us. We ask the question, if a tree falls in a forest and there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a sound? And it's the same kind of thing that I'm talking about here. We're not talking about the sun as a burning ball of gas. We're talking about the sun as providing certain functions for humans in God's image. And it can't do that until you've got humans in God's image. We'll come back to that issue. Now, in this way of thinking, when the text keeps saying it is good, you know, there's a lot of theological argument about what's going on. Some people say, well, since all creation was good, that means, see, we're interpreting, that means that everything was perfect, that people were fully righteous, Adam and Eve, the height of righteousness and perfection, that everything was morally upright. Right? These are all assumptions that we kind of drag in under this word good. Well, don't you think we ought to ask what the Hebrew author meant when he used the word good? After all, good could mean perfect. Good could mean morally upright. Good could mean righteous. Good means dozens of things. Just like the English word good, the Hebrew word tov has wide variability. So what does it mean here is our question. Now, the best way we would have to know that would be if the text would only give us a contrast of something that was not good, because then we could see what not good looked like, and that would help us know what good looked like. If only there was something that was not good. There is, of course. It is not good for man to be alone. Oh. So we're not talking about absolute perfection or righteousness. We're not talking about a moral issue or even a design issue. We're talking about functioning properly, ready to roll, working the way it was designed to work. It's a functional category. We get it from the text. So when I take off in a plane, I expect that before that plane takes off, the pilot's going through a pre-flight checklist. Working. Flaps, the engine, okay? The flaps are good, engine's good, food, marginal. good if they pay for it, you know. Okay, so going through that pre-flight check, it's good. And that's what's going on in Genesis 1. Everything's ready to roll. Okay, we're ready for wheels up. Is it ready to function? Genesis 1, then, I propose, provides an account of functional origins. That's the story it's telling. Functional origins, not material origins. Genesis 1 is about God bringing order, functionality, into the midst of non-order. Again, unpacking the boxes, bringing order to our world to work for us. Now, I would like to suggest that a way we can understand this is to To think about then how this relates to the world as God set it up. It's not going to help us to ask what things God created. Things is objects. If the text is not concerned with matter, that's not going to get us anywhere. Naming and separating are the creative acts in Genesis 1. And by the way, we find naming and separating as creative acts throughout the ancient Near East. So this is no surprise. Again, we don't have to haul it into the biblical text. It's already there. So they're looking at creation in slightly different terms. Let's talk about a contrast that can help us. We could talk about creation in terms of building a house. God building the cosmic house in which we live, the universe, constructing it physically, materially. We could talk about that house story, God building the cosmos. It's a valuable enough thing to talk about, and often in our scientific frame of thinking, that's how we think about it. God building this house. And we talk about cells and atoms and molecules, and we talk about quasars and dark holes and nebulae. All about the house story. And the more we've learned about the house story as the centuries move on, the more we've learned about the house story, the more we've begun to feel really kind of insignificant. We're puny. You know, the mass of humanity and the huge size of the globe and the vast stretches of the solar system and, wow, the Milky Way galaxy and then billions of galaxies in the universe, and we won't even get into multiverses. You know, we feel kind of puny, insignificant in the house story. Science explores the house story. It's what they do. They do it well. But is the Bible interested in the house story? I suggest not. When we think about order and organization, functionality, we're not talking about the house story so much as we're talking about making a home. There comes a point where that house becomes a home. The house could function as a house, but unless people are living there, it's not a home. You know, when the housing market crashed in the U.S., I don't know if it did here, but crashed in the U.S., what was it, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, something of that sort. You know, builders had built these houses that they expected to sell. And those houses had foundations that held up the house. They had a roof that covered the house over, protected it from the weather. They had plumbing and electricity, heating, air conditioning. All of those things were in it. They were all there in functional state, but not functioning, because there's nobody to flip the switches or turn the faucets. And so even though it existed as a house and theoretically was ready to function as a house, the home did not exist. The home cannot exist until someone moves into it. So you could talk about the existence of the house, and you can talk about the existence of the home. The house story and the home story are different stories. I grew up in Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, and I grew up in a suburb, housing developments, you know, that kind of experience. So not out on the farms and in the countryside, and certainly not in the city, just housing development suburbs. In a suburb real close to us, there in a housing development near us, there was the houses all built around in their normal kind of patterns, all around a big barn. And you know, you drive by and you say, that's really weird. There's this barn sitting in the middle of this housing development. And it's easy to figure out what happened. The farmer who had owned all the land decided finally to sell off to some developer, and he sold all of his property, his fields, and they built houses on it, but he didn't sell them the barn and the 2-3 acres that the barn was sitting on. So there it sat in the middle of the housing development. Now, there was a church about a half hour from us that decided they wanted to plant a church in our area, and they needed a place to meet. And their attention was caught by this barn. And so they decided that that barn was going to serve as a church. And that's the church I grew up in. It was called Center Square Chapel, and we met in the barn. And boy, they didn't do a lot to change around the barn. You know, a little linoleum on the floors of the biggest area so we could have a sanctuary. My Sunday school rooms were the stalls where the animals had been, still the half walls, you know, like you find in a barn. You always knew what was going on in the next grade because it's just half a wall, straw on the floor. I mean, it was a barn, but it was a church. And if you asked about, tell me how this church began, you wouldn't be expecting a detailed barn story. Okay, how the barn was built and what materials the barn used. That really wouldn't have a whole lot to do with the church, because the church had made that barn its home. And you could tell the house story, which is about the barn, the material barn, or you could tell the church story, the home story, about Center Square Chapel and the function that it had and the role that it played and the order that came into those walls when God's people met there. Different stories. Which story are we hearing about the cosmos? I would like to propose that we're hearing the home story, not the house story. Again, no doubt about it, God built the house. But to tell the house story assumes a certain aspect of how did the play begin. Remember that analogy. Okay, what are you asking when you ask how? Do we want to know how the house took its shape or how the home took its shape? And in the ancient world, I propose they were much more interested in the home story. And I suggest that we should be too. Not that we should neglect the house story. The house story is not wrong. It's just a different story. And if we try to treat this text as a house story when it's really supposed to be a home story, it'd be no wonder that we would come out a little bit confused. In the home story, we're not insignificant. We're honored guests. See, one of the revolutionary aspects of the biblical text in the ancient world was the view they had of people. In the ancient world, they might talk about the king as being in the image of God. But in the Bible, we're all in the image of God. And being in the image of God itself becomes a source of dignity that we have as the human race, a dignity that God gave us. And we find out in the biblical text that God did not create us to be his slaves. He created us to be his stewards and vice regents. See, in the rest of the ancient world, people were created to be slaves. In that Babylonian and Egyptian and Assyrian and Hittite and those cultures, the gods had needs. And the gods existed for a long time meeting their own needs, but it just got rather boring to work all the time. And so they decided we need somebody else to work to make life comfortable for us, to meet our needs. And so they created people. An afterthought. The gods, in that view, had created the cosmos for themselves, to function for them. And they never had people in mind. But then, needing someone to do the slave labor for them, they created people. And people were created then to meet the needs of the gods. Now, they met the needs of the gods by their rituals. Their sacrifices were food for the gods. Their libations were the drink for the gods. The temples were the luxurious homes of the gods. And so they met the needs of the gods. There was no sense of a need of relationship here. The gods in the ancient world did not want to be in relationship with people. Ew, scum. So relationship was not the goal of the gods. The goal of the gods was selfish, take care of us. And in return, the gods, of course, had to take care of people. You had to protect your slave labor, else you wouldn't get use from them. That's how people thought in the ancient world. And that's one of the things that the Bible says, oh no, we're going to change that. Let's fix that one up. And so God's revelation of himself says, you know, let's get something straight. I don't have any needs. Remember in Psalm 50, he says that, I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. If I were hungry, I wouldn't ask you. God doesn't have needs. So how does this all work? If God doesn't have needs, then how do the people relate to him? God says, what I want is your loyalty, your faithfulness. I want your love. I want a relationship. That's why I've created you. That's revolutionary. Nobody ever thought of that in the ancient world, that a God would want that. And you see, that's built into Genesis 1. God has not made this world for himself. He has made it for us. And he has made it with a particular purpose in mind. He wants to relate to us. He wants to provide this place for us, and he wants to live here with us. John 14, remember the conversation in the upper room? Jesus is telling the disciples he's going to be going away, and they're getting all, you know, that's a Greek word. Okay, no, so they're all concerned about, and Jesus says, don't be afraid. You know, I'm going to prepare a place for you so that where I am, you may also be. That wasn't the first time he did that. That's what he did here. He prepared this place for us so that where he is, we might also be. That's the home story. That's the story that vibrates through Genesis 1. And it's a story that we absolutely miss because we're too worried about science issues, the house story. The minute we make it a house story, we lose sight of the home story, its whole purpose for being. Now, how does this play out in Genesis 1? Well, we already talked about day one. On day one, God creates time. No objects here. This is not a material. This is not the house story. Okay, that's part of the home, how the home works for us, how the cosmos works for us, time. God didn't do that for himself. He did it for us. We get to day two, and we've got the putting up the Hebrew words, the rakia. And we argue, is that the firmament, like in the King James, solid sky? Is it the expanse, like the NIV, sort of the bubble, the air bubble that we live in? How do we interpret that word? It wasn't too long ago that I believed that it was the solid sky, and it might still be yet, but I've changed my mind on that because when I was writing my commentary on Job, I found another word that now I'm convinced is the solid sky, so it's not the same word as rakia. So the rakia is, in my mind, more the expanse, the air bubble. Remember when I showed you the Egyptian picture last night? There was the air god holding apart the earth and the sky. Okay, that air god plays a very significant role in their cosmology and in their understanding of the world in which they lived. And Rakia, I think, is that kind of thing. So God set up an expanse to separate the waters above from the waters below. Remember, as we mentioned last night, everybody in the ancient world believed in waters above and waters below. So this is not new information, and we don't have to find waters above scientifically, because the text isn't talking scientifically. It's talking about how people thought in the ancient world. See, that's like saying we don't have to try to figure out how our blood pumps do thinking, do cognitive processes, because that's just God using the language of the ancient world. We don't have to come up with a science that makes our blood pumps cognitive organs. Okay, and likewise, you don't have to go find the waters above. This is just the way they thought in the ancient world, and God's using that description to talk about the fact that he organized the cosmos. See, if we were thinking this was a material account, we might think we have to go figure that stuff out scientifically. But it's not a material account. And so we ask, what function is being set up here? The function in day two, what does the expanse and the waters above and waters below, what function does that have to do with? Weather. That's how they thought weather worked. So God uses their ways of thinking to describe weather systems. He doesn't use high-pressure systems and low-pressure systems and El Niño and things like that. He just talks about the way they thought about how weather works. He set it up. That's the second function. Third function, you know, it talks about the dry land will emerge. It doesn't say God made it. Of course he did, but it doesn't talk about that part of it. Let the dry land emerge. And let the plants sprout. It doesn't say God made them. Of course he did. But it's not saying that. He's talking about how this is all going to function, how it's going to work. And that all works to get us food. So in days 1, 2, and 3, we have three main functions. Time, weather, food. This is the creation account for everyone. Because no matter what culture or time you live in, no matter what language you speak or what era is yours, you always think about time, weather, and food. That's human life. These are the three major functions of human existence. And when people think about their world and the way that they get along in their world, those are the three things they talk about. That's what you'll talk about at the bus stop and in the grocery store. Time, weather, and food. Quarks and nebulae, not so much. Here's God talking to everybody, and it's about the most important things in our lives. How our world functions. These are the things that bring order to our world. That's the home story. Now, the Bible knows it's using these three categories. So Genesis 8, after the flood, God reestablishes order, reestablishes functions. Remember, it was all covered by the sea, non-order. Now he brings order out again, just like he did in Genesis 1. The people emerge, the dry land emerges, all the same things. Okay, but look at this. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, that's food. Cold, heat, summer, winter, that's weather. Day and night, that's time. The Bible knows what categories it's dealing with, and you can see the functional language very clearly here. So, days 1 through 3, functions are proclaimed. Time, weather, food. That's what days 1 through 3 are. The basis for time is light, but light is not an object. The basis for weather and space for existence, space, the expanse, is not an object. Basis for food provision, dry land emerges, plants sprout. You notice that if you thought this was about God making objects, what's going on in days 1 through 3? No objects are being made. But it's no surprise if you recognize that it's a text that talks about functions and order. Oh, I have to skip this. This shows you that in the ancient Near East, the cosmology texts do the same thing. Time, weather, food. And so we can't go through that in detail. Sorry, here's another one. This is from the totally other end of the ancient Near Eastern period, an Egyptian Ptolemaic text. And again, you can see that there's issues of functions that are being laid out here. Summer and winter, created food, light and darkness. This is how people thought in the ancient world. I went from that early cuneiform text, which was Sumerian, all the way through to an Egyptian Ptolemaic text. This is how they think in the ancient world. Across cultures, across the time of the ancient world, they are thinking of cosmology in terms of functions. The dream, wealth, food for the common man, succession of generations. This is a creation story in the ancient world. So, days 4 through 6 are no longer about functions themselves, they are about functionaries. Okay? Sun, moon, and stars are not functions. They are functionaries who have functions. So, the lights are for signs, celebrations, days, and years. Okay, so these are not functions. So 4 through 6 is different from 1 through 3. 4 through 6 is about functionaries, and those functionaries have functions. Now again, sun, moon, and stars. In the ancient world, the Israelites. Okay, let's take a minute. I know I'm pushing my time here, but let's take 1 minute and do this. When you think about the moon, what things come to mind? Rock, in orbit. Reflecting the light of the sun, 375,000 miles away. You might know the size of it. Rotating, revolving, all of these things are subconscious to us. right? That's what we think about the moon. Does Israel know any single one of those facts? That's not because they're stupid. It's just they have no way of coming to that information, and God doesn't reveal it to them. No one in the ancient world knew any of those things. What do they think the sun, moon, and stars are? Well, in the rest of the ancient world, they think they're gods, but Israel doesn't think that. What does Israel think they are? Exactly what they call them, lights. Right? You look at the northern lights or the southern lights. Do they have southern lights? I don't know. But you look at the northern lights, and you know that there's light there, but you don't think they're objects. Lights. And the Israelites understood sun, moon, and stars as lights, not as objects. Now, I know we realize they're objects, but they did not. And we're trying to think the way they think, so we have to say they were not thinking that this account in Genesis was about objects, because they didn't know they were objects. If you ever wondered why we have light in day one, sun, moon, and stars in day four, did that confuse you? It confused you because you thought it was a material account giving a sequence of material actions. That is an assumption, and I believe an unwarranted one. The functions are more important than the functionaries. Fish and birds teem and fill the world. How they function. Human beings in God's image, it's a function. Subdue and rule, that's a function. Male and female, that's a function. The text is interested in how the functionaries function in this home that God has set up. So, time, weather, and food are the functions in days 1 through 3. Lights, creatures, land creatures are all the functionaries in days 4 through 6. We can't do this. Image of God, we can talk about it. It's our function to serve God in that way. It's our identity, who we are. And we are his substitutes, his representatives. We represent his presence. Okay, that's just really quickly what we do there. We're not going to do that one either. We need to stop here for this one. Okay, so what we're going to do in the next hour, we've got a break now for morning tea. Have I got that right? Yeah. Morning tea. And so then we'll come back at 11, and we'll talk more about this home idea.